That's just history. Here in the United States, it starts before the Revolutionary War, before we had a organized government here. As early as the 1600s, there were Baptist churches here in the United States. We've established, and I'm just going to review a little bit to start with this evening, the first church in most of our history, our lineage, going back into this very same time, starts with the Welsh Tract Church. The name of it, they established in Delaware in 1701. They came from Wales, just in the northern regions of England. Sometimes it's considered a separate area, but of in England. The church there at Hillcliff Baptist Church. Thomas Griffith is a name that is going to be scattered through a lot of history books during that time. Colonies here in the United States, beginning with the even the founding of the Philadelphia Association. That Welsh Tract Church was one of the original churches that started that Philadelphia Association. There were only five of them. All five of those churches came from Wales. Some of the other Baptist churches, even in the area that were older than they are, were not a part of that originally, but the churches in the original Philadelphia Association, wasn't very long after that time that many other churches joined, but from that same area, churches that were familiar with one another. During that time, as we're going to look in the history, and for the next 100 years, they were even then very careful about who they would fellowship with and who they wouldn't, even among those who called themselves Baptists. So we talked a little bit last time, matter of fact, I remember about a phrase that came up I thought pretty interesting, that especially to find it that early in history. Somebody tell me if you have wrote down in your notes, what was the some of the discussion we had? What's the distinction between the old school and new school Baptists, even in the early 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s? There were already, I mean, we think today most Baptists, most modern Baptists, New School Baptists, by simple term and phrases we would understand them, is something that is practically new. You know what? The late 1800s, early 1900s, into almost all the 1800s, there was division among Baptists then of what were New Baptists, New School Baptists, and Old School Baptists. Anybody remember? Anybody write down what the differences of those were in your notes? Somebody who can tell me about that. What was the difference between old school and new school Baptists?
I have lineage for me.
Lineage, not so much, because a lot of them claimed that they would practice lineage. That wasn't one of the main distinctions of why they separated. Matter of fact, we're going to look at a second or third church this evening that divided, that had the same origin, but within that church is one of the first main divisions between old and new school because of some of their practices.
Primarily affiliation. Who they
would affiliate with.
Help allow and fellowship with, who they allow to be in their, what men they allow to be in their pulpits.
Okay, pulpit affiliation was a big thing even then in the 1700s and 1800s, that the old school Baptists just kept themselves separate, kept to themselves pretty carefully. They wouldn't accept alien baptism. They wouldn't even accept what we think of today, a lot of immersion, believers baptism, that wasn't enough for them.
What do you mean, like proper authority or proper administrator?
Proper authority and administrator, yes. We talked about administrator, didn't we? Administrator for baptism and the importance of that, because even in the 1600s, some were trying to call themselves Baptists, and we talked about it, if you remember, on both sides of the Atlantic. Some of it in England, some of it here in the United States. And just two or three people gathered together, they would baptize one another and try to form themselves into a Baptist church. And that is not proper administrator. Okay? No authority in that. We think that of modern practice. But that was going on in England even before people came here. And some were trying to continue that practice here. But especially the old school Baptists, that's one of the things they rejected altogether. Okay, Brother Daniel, had your hand up?
Yes, a general question in your reading of history and understanding history, taken from even Brother Cooper's class and everything. So 1776, obviously,
the founding of the United States.
Constitution come into play in the next, you know, the amendments come into play in the next couple of years, and then we have an explosion of Baptist churches kind of taking place.
Yeah.
And it's really not a long time from when we wanted to set down. Is there the sense of grounding? Are people missing the grounding because of that explosion, or is that just something I've been offered? Even though you're saying 1776 to 1850 when the Southern Baptist Convention, that's not a lot of 70 years.
Not a whole lot of grounding, but there is a whole lot of influence and a whole lot of compromise going on that the New School Baptists, because they're affiliating with and accepting baptism that don't have any authority from churches that don't have, and so I guess sorry if I jumped on real quick. As far as succession goes, that succession itself wasn't the issue, but because authority for baptism and administrator for baptism, remember one of the points I made, I don't think it was last weekend we were here, but weekend before. Both of those really depend on church succession, because if you don't have church succession, administrator, and even church authority, church voting, church gathering and meeting together doesn't mean anything if you don't have the right lineage. That's the importance of having lineage. Just a Baptist name isn't enough. And I bring all this about because we get accused today, and Baptists here in the Northwest have, in our generation, starting new trends that none of our Baptist forefathers ever did. That's all just those things are brand new. I'm emphasizing this because in the 1700s and 1800s, our Baptist forefathers contended for the same things. It's not anything new, Sister Rhonda.
But you talked about last time, the particular and general Baptists were, even before they came to this country, so the compromising didn't start here in America. The compromising was going on before that. And the term New School Baptist and Old School Baptist, did that just start with the split? Did that just start with the split there in 1814?
Let me check a reference before I add. It was right about that time, 1814, the early 1800s. Matter of fact, the other reference I was looking for is from a later church that I'll get to pretty quick in our church lineage, not the one at Wells Track, but the church in Hopewell Township, New Jersey, and it's in our lineage. I'll read it, or at least reference right there. They actually have a split between 1825 and 1830. And half of the church then is going to be known and recognized as the New School Hopewell Baptist Church. And the ones that wouldn't change any of their practice and customs of the old school Hopewell Baptist Church. They didn't call it something there. But the old school Hopewell Baptist Church in New Jersey. Okay. And so it's a lot of it, yes, as an answer to what Brother Daniel asked, they were not being grounded. Some of them were being grounded. But when divisions and disagreements came up, even in churches, fellowships, we have occasion, at least in one, in the fellowship originally with the Wealth Tract Church, they just refused to fellowship with other churches. The church in Hopewell Township, New Jersey, I'll go ahead and read pretty quick about this. They actually split almost in half, with some of them going out and being recognized as a New School Baptist Church, and the old church being, they kept, both of them kept the name Hopewell Baptist Church. But the ones who went out and separated and even found other land were Hopewell New School Baptists. So the ones who stayed there with all the original records and were a stronger part of the two contenders were old school Baptists that didn't compromise, that didn't accept, that didn't practice and allow other things just to make them smooth and so that they could have more people.
Did you say a year
before that? That split took place.
No.
The record is in their history that I copied this from the history and even the current museum that was put together this article in 2024, during the second quarter of the 19th century.
Okay.
So that would have been 1825 to 1830.
Okay,
when this took place.
We may cover this last time up here. Did it say why that Hopewell Baptist Church split? Was it, you know what, pulpit affiliation, you know what they were?
There wasn't as much pulpit affiliation as it was at the time and in reading the histories, as it was the being able to establish the proper baptism, proper authority, proper administrator for new members that would come in. That was something that was even a big issue with them early in the 1800s. We're told today by a lot of people, and sometimes when people split from us, well, that's not really an issue, and you guys are starting something that nobody's ever contended for before. That's not true and accurate at all. Okay, Sister Rhonda.
Well, in this 1914 with the Triennial Convention, which is the roots of the Southern Baptist Convention, it already was established there, not only the corporate affiliation, but also the hierarchy.
In 1814, the hierarchy, and what was the other, really the main thing with that Triennial Convention? They're supporting and taking, even if they're not having Protestants and other denominations preach, they're supporting the mission work of Protestants internationally, and that's what generally what that Triennial Convention was, and why the Wealth Tract Church and this Hopewell Church and others refused to participate in that. And because of that, some of them then even go by the name, their group of churches, as Old School Association, to separate themselves. That was what they were using on the East Coast, even before there were many churches, even as far west as the Mississippi River. I mean, we're still talking 1700, early 1800s, very early. Josh,
just going back briefly to the Daniel question about grounding, also those churches. A lot of the churches in the, especially later in the Philadelphia Association, were weakened somewhat because a lot of their ministers and a lot of their stronger men who were teachers and more established, many of them left and joined Washington's Revolutionary Army in the hopes of being able to be a part of something that the church, that their churches could worship with more freedom and have more rights. So a lot of those ministers left and joined Washington's army, which weakened churches.
Yeah, maybe what weakened those churches, and you don't see it in history, but it becomes almost obvious if you think about it, it's just a natural progression of that. There was a great weakening of churches during both the Revolutionary War and in the mid-1800s, 100 years later. The Civil War. During both of those times, the churches are weakened, not only because the men and many of the ministers took part in and many of them went to war and just never came back home. And they were weakened and not grounded because of both of those conflicts. But even the Revolutionary War, especially the church there at Hopewell, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was a member there. I mean, and a judge there in New Jersey, well-known, prominent, but he was a member of this church at Hopewell that we're talking about in the mid-1700s. Okay. I don't get real fascinated with men and names, but it's good to know and interesting to me to find some individual traced or at least referenced over and over again by so many different histories during this time that were prominent in the history of some of these churches. First one that I made mention of, the pastor who came over here from the Oak Cliff Baptist Church, Elder Thomas Griffith. Sometimes if you're reading about that time from 1700 to about 1750, 1756, almost 1780, I think that's when he died. His name is going to be Thomas Griffin, same individual, it's just transposed differently in some history books. That was the first pastor of the church, of the Welsh Tract Church that came across the Atlantic from the Hillcliff Church there in Wales. Yes.
An N?
Sometimes with an N. Most of the time, the most credibly, it's Griffith with an H on the end. Okay, but I've found some history books that, and some will correct it even when they say Griffin, but not all of them will. So that's just something to look for and be aware of. After the church there at Wells Tract, and I think there was just one more thing I wanted to make mention of concerning them before I read that. Okay, so in 1836, and so a long time after, and even a generation or two later from when they first started, the association that the Welsh Tract Church there in Delaware was a part of refused by vote to receive into the fellowship, their association, persons baptized who were engaged in the newfangled systems of the day. Okay. So they were rejecting not only baptisms, but churches that were part of that triennial convention that they would vote against and vote to keep them out of their fellowship and at that time their association. That was in 1836, the first time they're voting to do that. 20 years later, in 1856, for the first time, the association is called in the minutes the Delaware Old School Baptist Association. Okay. And so that's 40 years, almost 50 years after that triennial convention. But they have that distinction and that name. That's their reputation and even the name they adopt for their association by themselves to show the difference in the distinction that is seen in that. Okay. They're in Delaware that the Welsh Tract Church was a part of. Now, looking at our lineage, after the Welsh Tract Church, about halfway into the next article that starts with the church at Warren County, Kentucky, the next one that is referenced directly in our church lineage, about halfway into that paragraph, there's a statement that comes out this way, and I'll read this to you. I'm sorry if we don't have a copy of it, we can make them available. But I have highlighted, and I want to at least bring a couple of things out here. The work of the New Testament churches in Kentucky, where this church in Warren County, the Providence Church of Warren County, Kentucky, came from, came about as a direct work of Brother John Gano, G-A-N-O. He is very prominent in a lot of history books around the area of Kentucky. Okay? And during that time of the, even 18, as late as 1850, sometime after that, I'll give reference to it here in just a minute. He was a Baptist preacher that was forward in presenting Jesus Christ to the world. He was saved as an adult, scripturally baptized, called of God into the ministry, and then ordained by the Hopewell Baptist Church of Hopewell Township, New Jersey, in May of 1754. And so I've gotten, and I just wanted to reference a couple of different things about this Hopewell Baptist Church in New Jersey. They're not directly in our lineage, although in the histories, Griffith was a part of and went as far as and helped start, if not directly, at least was there at the organization and at other ordinations with this same old school church in Hopewell, New Jersey. And so there's part of the direct contact with that. While Griffith was pastor of that Welsh Tract Church in Delaware. Okay, so John Gano was the one who was very prominent in the starting of, most probably the even a starting pastor involved in. He's not. Well, I guess he is. Even Isaac Eaton, another prominent name that comes up. Gano was directly involved with this, though. The next church in our lineage is this Provident Church of Warren County, Kentucky. So we've got, and looking at direct lineage, again, in multiple places, you can look in Christian's book, Ashcraft's book. If you look for that name, Gano, John Gano, as well as Thomas Griffith, they're going to be in a few different articles and even chapters in there because of their prominent work, not only in the association, but through individual churches, helping and starting churches, as well as being around for the ordination and support and strengthening of other churches. Okay. This Providence Church of Warren County, Kentucky, one of several churches comprising the Warren Association of Baptist Churches, which came directly out of the churches of that Philadelphia Association of Churches, originally the Welsh Tract and Cohansey, Middletown, Lower Dublin, Piscataway. Those are the five from Wales that started originally that Philadelphia Association. Now, Philadelphia Association has a lot of conflict and debate come up about, and sometimes because of the way their articles of faith are even presented and stated, many of them later that almost seem to get deeper and more refined, defining Calvinistic teaching concerning salvation. But the churches in its origin were not that way. And let's remember again, too, and we've already looked at and established from what Christian brings out, they refused and rejected and would not associate with Calvinistic peculiar churches in England before they came over here. They remained separate and distinct because they were not going to be recognized. They were not going to fellowship with those that were hardline Calvinists in their preaching and teaching. Okay, Sister Rhonda.
Well, and if you look at what they're fighting against, they're fighting for me, and what they're fighting against, that's why they worded their thing of faith when they did. So if you go through the history and look at their practices, they aren't practicing Calvinistic doctrine, even though when we read their statement of faith, that's what it sounds like to us, but that was not their practice.
Yeah, that was not their practice. That was not what their teaching held to. Okay, concerning this, Brother Mike, I'm sorry.
that the same rules were referred and were the Philadelphia Association in 1965, 1970, in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure our history would read very similar.
Yeah.
Over, you know, churches taking a stand, churches leading, and
church authority and some of the things we have stood on. Yeah. People will take some of those, and particularly statements, to extreme, out of context, some of them. That's not real uncommon, not only historically, but still presently today. I mean, I've been accused of and been had things approached and brought to my attention. I'm not going to have time to bring out this evening, but well, I'm sure before we're done this year, misquoting very directly, stating just the opposite, even if some of the sources that they use. But if you're not familiar with or don't have those things to look at and to have in front of you,
well, let's just run it about the time that it wrote. What are you dealing with?
Yep.
And, you know, keep it in the context and the time. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to do that throughout, especially when you're reading history.
There are available in the histories of books, and I haven't gotten read through all. I plan on, I haven't even become familiar, knowledgeable of that. Welsh Tract Church, even when it came here to the United States, many of their early records have had to have been translated because they're stated in the Welsh language. Okay, which is different than even the English that was being spoken and written in the in England at the time. The history, even as late as at least what starts and what's available in the 1700s and 1800s in the Hopewell Township Church, is again sometimes hard to decipher. If you have anybody try to look through any of the literature and records, even original King James Bibles from the 1600s, they are slow and hard to do. This is the a page of the history of that from the Hopewell Church, handwritten and in Old English. That a couple of weeks back, I asked everybody, when you're reading through, whether it be Christian's book or even Ashcraft's, and it's modern English, don't try to speed read it. You're going to miss a lot. It's impossible to read speed read through this stuff. You've got to decipher. Brother Mike's laughing. You've got to decipher and figure out and be slow enough to know what's an F and what's an S and what half words are, and sometimes things that aren't even spelled consistently on the same page, because that's how the form of literature, and that's practically all the records that we have of 1600s and 1700s. Okay? The Constitution of the United States wasn't written that way by John Hancock. Well, it was, because he had good handwriting. But they didn't have printing presses, and they didn't have the thing fully available and able to be used. And even then, they were not readily available for everyone. This is how church records would be. This is how histories would be in their original form. If not, in a Welsh language that probably nobody in this room would be able to translate. Okay, they are available that way, but hard and tedious many times to go through and find really valuable things in there. We still haven't, we're not going to take time this weekend to talk about the importance of what's one of the other traits that they had to contend for, at least known for back in those times, both in England and in the United States, was their practice of laying on of hands. When the Bible talks about laying on of hands, there were two or three reasons for it, even in the New Testament. What were those?
Church lineage.
Church lineage. Okay, starting churches, passing on by, and so church lineage,
ordinations,
Why would an ordination and laying on of hands have mattered in the 15th and 16th, 17th century?
Or is that mean?
If you weren't properly ordained, then you weren't qualified to baptize. Laying on of hands. If an individual was baptized but never had hands laid on them, this is one of the contentions that's easy for us. And I don't want us to get overly legalistic. They almost had to because of what they were contending for, though. If people's claiming they had believers baptized and they were immersed, even maybe by a particular individual, but never had hands laid on them, let me translate for our modern practice. If the word ever accepted it with the right hand of fellowship into a New Testament church, they were probably never church members to begin with. Which at least set up red flags, then they would investigate their baptism. And if they didn't have good scriptural proper baptism, what would they do? They would baptize them again. I mean, there's simple things for us that when you read about in history, why would laying on of hands be an issue that only two or three or four churches, sometimes when you read about them, in an area of 50 or 60 of them, separated themselves? Because the important thing was that we don't think of, and you'll never, I don't know that you'll hardly ever find a historian write about this, but if they don't join a church with the proper qualifications and steps, and if they're not baptized properly, if they're not saved, if that's not fully established, for us, it's church covenant. What does it mean for the individual? They don't have the Holy Spirit as comforter. I haven't read through all the translated history of that Welsh tract church, but I wouldn't be surprised even sometimes the Holy Spirit and their relationship with the Holy Spirit is going to come out, even if that word comforter isn't used there. We recognize it because in our English Bibles, it is there, even though some Baptists have never heard that before. It's almost like they've never read the book of John. I don't know. But we've never heard of it before. It's right there.
That's an image.
But there were reasons, there were reasons for that in the first century. Reasons for it today. Historically, but I get kind of excited when I see some of those churches contending for the same thing, even if they're not explained exactly the same way. It becomes pretty evident without having to read in between the lines what they were standing for. You know what they were standing for? Scriptural baptism. Proper authority. Church fellowship. Why would that matter? Sometimes when you read in history, it seemed like and almost as if they were practicing, and maybe they were open communion. But you know who they would have fellowship with? Even members? If they didn't have hands laid on them. Why? Because they wouldn't submit to the order and the discipline, the covenant of the church. That's what the laying on of the hands meant for them. Brother Daniel.
Just got to emphasize the very same thing. You said, yeah. You don't know what that laying on of hands is. You're going to miss it. Now, the Bible does talk about it. It talks about the importance of it. What does it really come down to? The authority and administrator.
The authority and administrator.
Right along with that, the comforter.
And the comforter.
It's saying the same thing.
And if they're not members of the church and you're not fellowshipping with them as church and church members, you can't have fellowship with them, even in the Lord's Supper. We don't see and recognize and call that practice today the laying on of hands. But it is our vote in church recognition, at least, of what and how they become church members. Why is that important? Well, that's just an old tradition. No, there's a biblical origin for it. And it's interesting, in history, some of our forefathers practiced that with importance that may not have been understood even in the reading. But boy, it's sure identical, seems to be, even to what our important doctrines are today, Brother Bo.
So in Acts 10, what we're talking about here, it happened like this, what you're bringing out, a little bit different, because when the Gentiles spoke in tongues, that was a sign.
Yeah.
But the brother in that with Peter that went with him from Joppa, he said, "Can any deny these baptisms?" And because clearly they have received the Holy Ghost.
That's comforting.
And later in chapter 15,
that the council needs to be bring that again, recounting that history. But and obviously the sign there was, or them speaking in tongues, like I said, it wasn't a sign, but it denoted that they were worthy of scriptural baptism.
Sure.
And then they went ahead and it says in verse 48, commands them to be baptized in the name of the Lord. And so, I mean, that was a sign of not only a church needing to be established there with the Gentiles, but signs of the brethren who were with Peter from Joppa. He's saying, we can't deny them. They're scriptural candidates for baptism, and this is the scriptural makings of a New Testament church.
Real quickly, and I'll give you the other biblical reference for it, or two more, to establish this. I know Brother Cooper is just itching to get up here. In the 8th chapter and in the 19th chapter of the book of Acts, there's one other thing that many times we don't emphasize in the order that's found in both of those passages.
Stop.
Individuals are saved. They give testimony to that. Yep. They're scripturally baptized, and then what happens? There's laying on of hands of them in the 8th chapter and in the 19th chapter. That was a practice that was important in the first century. I think our forefathers saw and recognized that as important. That's not explained a whole lot. They were just weirdos who practiced the ordinance of laying on of hands. Who does that?
There's never this word before. Never an intention of fellowship.
In the 8th and the 19th chapters of the book of Acts, they practiced that, and it was important. In both of those passages. We'll come back. If you have questions, write them down. We'll come back and look at another scripture tomorrow. Brother Sean.
John Gano. He the one before the independence. Yeah, he drew boundaries in the colonies. When he wanted those,
yeah.
But yeah.
He was at one time, yeah.
We also record that he baptized George Washington.
Yeah, he also baptized George Washington during that time.
Yeah.
Just a year or two, I think, before the independence of the United States. So, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.